Good evening, Truth Seekers. Mike Malloy here. Thanks for tuning in. Whew, close call. We're getting ready for more bad weather. If you hear a dated rebroadcast tomorrow night, it's because the storms have knocked us off. Hey, this hour is sponsored by Gordon in Oklahoma City. Thank you, Gordon. He has a message with his sponsorship tonight. The message is, I've got it right here. I would like to share a quote from Mother Jones, Gordon writes. Here it is. We must be together. Our masters are joined together, and we must do the same thing. Let me try that again. We must be together. Our masters are joined together, and we must do the same thing. Quote from Mother Jones. From Gordon in Oklahoma City. Thank you, Gordon, for the sponsorship. I was watching... What's his name? Brian Williams tonight on the on NBC newscast. I don't know why I do that. I here in the Metro Atlanta area, we get Brian Williams first at 6:30 in the evening, and then at 7, who's the ABC woman? Not
Andrea Mitchell?
No, not Andrea Mitchell. Not Paula. Not Katie Couric, she's CBS. Who is it? Come on.
The airbrush woman.
Yeah.
Diane Sawyer.
Diane Sawyer, thank you. God. Talk about lack of brand identification.
I am not trying to be petty or cruel or mean or anything, but if they put any more Vaseline on the lens of that camera when they're shooting her, you know, I'm going to have to go buy glasses. I think everybody must just think they're nearsighted or something. She is so out of focus.
Thank you.
Have you not noticed that?
Thank you very much.
Isn't it irritating?
Anyway.
I have to squint.
I can barely
make out her features.
I was watching NBC tonight with Brian Williams, and I think the totality of the newscast is 22 minutes after you discount for the commercials. And there were two stories that worked its way into that 22 minutes. Now, keep in mind, Brian Williams is paid $8 million a year, or is it 10, to deliver to a rapidly aging and rapidly diminishing news consumer every evening as people are in the middle of dinner or finishing dinner. This is a time-honored tradition. NBC Nightly News, it goes back two generations, maybe three generations, right? So tonight's newscast, Brian Williams, two of the stories taken out of his 22 minutes. One was about 3.5 to 4 minutes long, which is an eternity in broadcast news. It's a fairly long chunk in cable news, but in broadcast news, it's an eternity. You know what it's about? Paul Simon turning 70. Now, don't misunderstand. I love Paul Simon's music. Love it. It's the soundtrack of my misspent youth and beyond. I love Paul Simon music. Even back when he was with Garfinkel. I love it all. Simon and Garfinkel. I love it all. All of Paul Simon's music. But for God's sake, a 4-minute segment in the NBC Nightly News. Okay. Now, that was towards the end of the newscast. Two stories before that was a real bone crusher. I mean, this was so, I mean, think about what's going on planet Earth. Think about the stories that desperately need attention. You know what the story is about on NBC Nightly News? About two of the longest running soap operas on television being canceled. And what a tragedy it was. What a tragedy. What were people going to do? I watched the NBC Nightly News tonight, and when it was all over, I thought to myself, why do you do this? Why do you do this? Why do you take a half an hour, if you watch both of them? Usually, I'm here in the studio right around 6:30 to begin finalizing show prep. So I flip on the monitor right here, the TV monitor, and so it's not like dedicated time to watching Brian Williams and Paula Zahn, Diane Sawyer, Katie Couric, whoever the hell it is. I just turn it on. Instead of turning on Phineas and Ferb or SNL reruns or something, I turn on NBC Nightly News. Astonishing. So, Brian Williams, shame on you. One thing that was interesting, somebody sent me the videos from MSNBC, Chris Matthews, was interviewing former Republican Senator and Debt Commission co-chair Alan Simpson, Republican from Wyoming. Alan Simpson, he's a real pisser, isn't he? But sometimes he's kind of like Barry Goldwater was on certain issues. Alan Simpson is a disappearing breed of Republican. That may be good or bad, depending on your point of view. I find him highly entertaining when he's not desperately threatening. But tonight he was kind of entertaining. He was asked, Matthews asked Alan Simpson to weigh in on the Republican field of potential presidential candidates that are out there right now. This collection of jackasses, half-wits. I mean, have you ever seen anything like this? And Rick Santorum today, with that little baby voice, says, I'm going to start a committee. We're going to go ahead and start exploratory. Rick, you have as much chance being elected president as my dog does, okay? Go find another formaldehyde-soaked fetus and amuse yourself. But and Trump? Chris Matthews asked Alan Simpson about the potential presidential candidates in the Republican Party. Simpson unloaded on what he called the homophobes and hypocrites in his own party, but especially in this field of jackasses that think they're going to be president. Simpson did describe New Jersey Governor Chris Christie as being, quote, quite awesome, end quote. You got to be kidding me. But I'll get to that a little bit later about Chris Christie. Simpson was particularly critical of former Senator Rick Santorum. Simpson said, Santorum said cruel things about homosexuals. Very cruel things. Why does he say cruel things about homosexuals? Huh? He said, we have homophobes in our party. That's disgusting to me. We're all human beings. We're all God's children. I'm not sticking with people who are homophobic or anti-woman. You know moral values when you're diddling your secretary while you're giving a speech on moral values. Come on, get off of it. I liked that line. And then the part I really like, he said, I don't think men legislators should even vote on the issue of abortion. How about that? while you're moral values. Yeah, moral values while you're diddling your secretary, while you're giving a speech on moral values. Come on, get off it. Oh, Alan, you just made me breathe hard today.
Rage Against the Flying Monkey Right with Mike Malloy.
Past the hour. Alice in Canada wrote regarding Obama's speech last night that we gnawed at a bit. She writes, "Hi, Mike. Listen to you all the time. I liked Obama's speech yesterday, and my take on it regarding the economy is that this poor guy is between a rock and a hard place. I really do believe his heart is in the right place for your country, but he's up against the most powerful forces in the world, the corporate powers that run the planet. I think that the office of president is pretty powerless, and the backroom boys run the show. We are fighting an election in our country here in Canada right now and hope to get rid of our neoconservative prime minister, who, as far as I'm concerned, takes his marching orders from the Republican machine in the United States. All us poor schmucks can do is hope for the best, and I hope that Canada will step up to the plate and vote. You always make me go off to sleep at night. Thinking." Alice in Canada. Thank you, Alice. Yeah. Governor Christie, that Alan Simpson finds just charming and delightful, and I don't know, I thought I saw Alan Simpson shiver when he mentioned Christie's name. Christie has virtually declared war on the state's labor unions. According to Think Progress, and everybody knows that Christie is having has an antagonizing style of politics. Like when he told a teacher to quit, when she talked about how his politicking was hurting the reputation of educators in the state. Well, you don't like it, quit. His latest foray into his bullying big man tactics. He asked a group of reporters yesterday to, quote, take the bat out. What is that, a New Jersey expression? Take the bat out on a 76-year-old female legislator, Senator Loretta Weinberg, because she has the temerity to collect a pension in addition to her part-time salary as a legislator. The way it was reported, Governor Christie told reporters Wednesday to take the bat to 76-year-old Senator Loretta Weinberg. He said, for collecting a taxpayer-funded pension. Oh, don't you love that? A taxpayer-funded. Well, no kidding. Governor Christie works on a taxpayer-funded salary. So what? A taxpayer-funded pension while making $49,000 a year as a legislator. Ooh! Christie said to a crowd of reporters at a State House news conference, quote, "I mean, can you guys please take the bat out on her for once? There's a woman Well, no, she did it. Yeah, she comes to you and she's pining. Oh, my goodness, how awful this is. What a double standard. But she's the queen of double standard. End quote. Really? The queen of double standard. Asked about Christie's comment, Senator Weinberg replied, quote, the guy's a little over the line. I'll continue criticizing on the issues I think I should criticize him on. NorthJersey.com notes that Miss Weinberg, a widow, lost most of her savings in Bernie Madoff's Ponzi scheme, which is why she applied for retirement benefits to supplement her part-time legislator's income. Hey, why don't you guys take the bat on her for once, huh? Take the bat on her. Yeah. Crush her goddamn head. That's what I'm saying. You know what I'm saying? Take the bat on her. Break her kneecaps, right? Hey. Hey. Kneecapper, you know, we got the meadowlands over here. We got the pine forest over here. You know what I'm saying? Goddamn double dipper. She's being paid on taxpayer money.
So are you.
What?
So are you.
Hey, take the bat on him too, right? Jesus, these guys are just, aren't they just wonderful examples of leadership? No, they're Republicans. And this is what Republican scum do. Look at them. Pawlenty, Santorum, Christie, these swine who are governors of Michigan and Wisconsin. Look at them. Look at them. We'll be right back.
Another cup of coffee. Here's Mike Malloy.
Look at them yo-yos. That's the way you do it. You play the guitar on the MTV. That ain't working. That's the way you do it. Money for nothing and your chicks for free. Now that ain't working.
About 25 before the hour. This hour is sponsored by Gordon in Oklahoma City. He has a message with his sponsorship. It says, I would like to share a quote from Mother Jones. We must be together. Our masters are joined together, and we must do the same thing. Now, he's not talking about the magazine. He's talking about the union organizer, Mother Jones, after whom the magazine was named, but Gordon is referring to the real person. You know, when I first saw this, I wasn't too sure. It's from a newspaper in Medford, Massachusetts. Nancy Pelosi was at Tufts University Friday afternoon when the federal budget was still in gridlock in Washington. And Pelosi said, quote, minute to minute, hour to hour, we're getting reports. As long as we don't have to take something to the floor, I can be with you right now. She was the guest for a lecture. She took the stage shortly after 2 p.m. Friday and gave a brief speech, then answered some questions. She said the issues holding back the federal budget had been narrowed to about half a dozen, including funding for Planned Parenthood and clean air, clean energy programs. She said, quote, there were 50 and then there were 25. Now it's down to about six areas of policy disagreement. The policy issues don't really belong in this kind of bill, but nonetheless, they are there, end quote. Then she said, quote, you really can't split the difference if splitting the difference mean half the kids are going to be thrown off Head Start, but not the full number, or that half the homebound seniors will lose meals. You can't just talk about dollars. You have to talk about values. And then she spoke out against a government shutdown. She said, quote, it's really unfair to the American people. It will create a level of payouts that is unworthy if it were to shut down. It's not a tactic or a strategy that is worthy of the aspirations of the American people, end quote. And then she said, quote, I want you to listen. Try to make sure that the values that I'm sure we all share are reflected in the choice you make. Another way I would say to my Republican friends, take back your party. So it doesn't matter so much who wins the election, because we have shared values about the education of our children, the growth of our economy, how we defend our country, have civil liberties, how we respect our seniors, end quote. That kind of got my attention. It doesn't matter. Take back your party, she said to the Republicans, so that it doesn't matter so much who wins the election, because we have shared values. Well, I rest my case, and I think anybody who has ever pointed out that there is truly not a dime's worth of difference between these two parties, I just wish that, rather than wish, I'll say it this way. When I'm king of America, which I plan on being at some point, you know, just for a day, but when I'm king of America, I'm going to abolish the system of government that we have and replace it with the parliamentary system. And that will open things up to all sorts of political parties. It'll be necessary, absolutely imperative for coalition building, especially in this country. You know, in a lot of countries where you have parliamentary systems, you have conservatives, liberals, and then you have the leftists, you have the Labor Party. You know, you might have three or four parties, but everything is so crazy in this country. If we had a parliamentary system, we would probably be more like Israel. We would have like 8 or 10 political parties, so it would be absolutely, utterly, completely necessary to build coalitions, to try to work together, like the Italians, I guess. You know, we'd have the Greens, the Democrats, Republicans, Liberals, the Tea Party, or the Tea Bag, a group of maniacs. We would have the Trump Party. We would have Progressive Party. We would have the Democrat Farmer Labor Coalition. We would, you know, really, there'd be 8 or 10 parties, and that's what I'm going to do. That's what I'm going to do. I am going to utterly destroy and blow up our system of government and replace it with the parliamentary system. How's that? Okay, that's my contribution to saving the republic. James in Seattle writes about those elections in Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, and Florida. You know, the ones where the Republicans took over. He says there's one other item you pondered the other night, which I've been thinking about a good deal lately, both at the local and national level. Locally, He's from Seattle. One would hope Seattle was a city beyond election fraud, but I've always considered Seattle and San Diego to be in close competition as to which city would be the most corrupt on the West Coast. Back in the 90s, in the late 90s, we had a beloved city council member, Charlie Chong, a humble, super sharp, and acerbic-tongued where dishonest and inept politicians were concerned, a guy who ran for mayor. Now, all the referenda Charlie supported passed during that election. And the other fellow, a swinish jerk named Paul Schell, was against all those referenda. But Schell came out of nowhere with absolutely no constituent base, which Charlie did possess, and won the mayor's position quite handily. Now, Charlie was Asian American, specifically Chinese American, and one might surmise that perhaps racism was involved in his defeat, although as a local and aware of the local feelings, I would find this absurd. But to give credence to my opinion, Gary Locke, another Chinese American, took the vast majority of the vote around the same time in Seattle for county executive, and later when he ran for governor. And I'm strictly referring to the extremely measured Seattle voting demographics. Now, I think that the mayor's election was a decidedly rigged election. So then the thought progresses to the nation's gubernatorial elections. And did those people really elect the governors of Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, and Florida? One might posit that they then deserved what they got. Except, what are the major qualifications of Robert Gates for Secretary of Defense? Huh? Well, his very last position, other than sanitizing the Bush Library at whatever Texas university it's at, Gates' last position before being named Secretary of Defense was as a special advisor to a company called Vote Here, a voting machine software company and lobbyist firm in Bellevue, Washington. Now, Vote Here was involved in programming cryptographic software patches for all voting machines. The reason? To secure them. Also, Vote Here was heavily involved in lobbying for the passage of the Help America Vote Act legislation to give the individual state's attorneys general the responsibility and oversight for elections across the state. Ooh. I'm really uncertain about the efficacy of those elections. If it could happen in Seattle, I don't doubt it could happen many, many other places besides Cuyahoga County, Ohio. James in Seattle. Yeah, that's you know, and I know, and obviously James knows, but we know this. We know this. That election fraud, not voter fraud. That's how these bastard Republicans like to be. Voter fraud! There are two people in Cleveland that voted in the wrong precinct. Voter fraud! No. Election fraud is rampant in this country. And the reason I believe that, I'm sure anyone who believes that has their reason, the reason I believe it is because sane people, seriously, sane people do not elect Republicans, especially this crop of sick bastards that has cropped up like so many mushrooms in cow pies. And to the person who emailed me and said those mushrooms that come up in cow pies are pretty damn good. No kidding. But anyway, I digress. Nobody in their right mind would elect these Republicans. If I vote for them, we have crazy people, politically nutballs, in any society, especially in ours. But, okay, so 10% of the population has a right to be politically insane. You still don't elect Republicans. I want to make more money than I can spend. I want to build more bombs than I can send. Somewhere I can even spell the name of. Welcome to the new American century. Yeah, welcome to the new American century.
Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour, and again, this hour was sponsored by Gordon in Oklahoma City, who would like to share a quote from the real Mother Jones. Excuse me, I had to sneeze. The quote from Mother Jones, the person, not the magazine. We must be together. Our masters are joined together, and we must do the same thing. The great union organizer, Mother Jones. From the Holland, Michigan Sentinel, are you an American employee? If so, today's column will likely offend you. If you'd rather not be offended, read no further. If you continue and then complain, I'm sorry, but that simply proves you're, well, stupid. Then again, stupidity plays a large role in today's topic. Still reading? Okay. You've had fair warning. So, you're an American employee. Maybe you make car parts. Maybe you're an engineer or designer. Maybe you're an accountant, store clerk, or tradesman. Whatever you do, you're probably stupid or lazy. Yes, I wrote it, and I mean it. You are either stupid or lazy. Maybe both. Now, I'm not referring to your work ethic or job performance. No, most of you are competent and devout to your profession or vocation. I'm addressing the way you view economics and employment. I'm challenging your gumption to advocate for yourself and your fellow Americans. Here's what I mean. Remember the Reagan standard? Are you better off today than you were a decade ago? Two decades? Three? Unless you make more than $380,000 a year, the answer is no. In fact, your standard of living over the last quarter century has actually decreased, while millionaires have added 30% to their net wealth. Why? Two reasons. First, hundreds of thousands of manufacturing jobs went overseas, while the politicians you elected did nothing to stop them. Yet you continue to elect leaders who offer nothing but tax cuts, as if that would stem the flow of disappearing jobs. Did you demand your leaders address America's trade imbalance or continuing outsourcing of jobs? Did you demand your leaders require foreign countries to buy a dollar's worth of American goods for every dollar of goods they sell here? No, and no, you didn't bother. You simply crossed your fingers and prayed, I hope my job's not next. You made concessions to your employer and hoped that would stem the exodus of jobs, or at least yours. How'd that work out for you? Second, you bought into the myth that unions are the cause of America's demise. You didn't bother to learn America became a world power when union membership was at its peak. You didn't bother to learn America became the envy of the world while one out of every three Americans was a union member. So, how are things going for you? How do your benefits compare to a quarter century ago? Are you paying a higher or lower percentage of your income for health insurance? Does your company offer a pension plan, or do you now fund your own 401k? Maybe you're thinking, I'm not a union worker, so this doesn't affect me. Stop being stupid. Union benefits provide a standard other companies have to match, or at least come close to. When those benefits are cut, yours are too, or do you think you operate in your own little employment vacuum? To make matters worse, you're again being played for a chump. The same puppets who did nothing while your standard of living decreased are now using the oldest gimmick in the book, jealousy, to continue their assault on American workers. Rather than protect Americans' jobs, they deflect your attention through jealousy. They cry, cut the pay of government workers, increase their health premiums, decrease their pensions, break their unions. After all, you've suffered, so they should suffer too, right? And in your misery, you buy their argument while more jobs head overseas. Pretty stupid, huh? If their antics weren't so pathetic, if the consequences weren't so dire, if they didn't prey on your stupidity, and if you didn't buy into their convoluted reasoning, this whole situation would be laughable. But of course it's not. I warned you I'd likely offend you, and I suspect I did. But once you overcome your anger, consider my analysis. Then either wise up and do something about it, or resign yourself to a lower standard of living for the next 10 years. Nice piece. Ray Buersma, Holland, Michigan Sentinel. Nice piece of writing, Ray. Way to go. It's something that you, Truth Seeker, and I, your humble and obedient servant, have been wondering for how long now? I mean, Reagan had the ability to fool me once. Okay, all right. But for 30 years, I don't mean I voted for him. I mean, you know, fooling people into becoming so-called Reagan Democrats. You know, Reagan stood there with just an endless supply of hangman's nooses. And he just smiled and handed them out as so-called Reagan Democrats walked by. Hi, how are you, mommy? You got another one? Here you go. Here's a noose. Here's another one for you. And millions, literally millions of rank-and-file Democrats walked by good old Ronald Reagan and took their hangman's noose and then went home and applied it. So for 30 years, this has been going on. And a lot of folks have been talking about it, warning about it, pointing it out. You know it. I know it. Ray knows it. Stupidity. Truly stupidity. Not ignorance. Stupidity. Stupid. Totally stupid. Who did this to us? Who allowed this country to go from being an attempt at representative government into a corporatocracy? Who did this? Who did it? Huh? We'll be back after the break. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Protection.
Program. This hour, excuse me, allergies, pollen, so thick down here you can walk on it. This hour is sponsored by Blue Lady. Blue Lady is sponsoring this hour. She has a message. The sponsorship is brought to you in honor of Ben Birch. At the White Rose Society, please go to whiterosesociety.org and pitch in to support the wizard behind the curtain that keeps liberal radio alive for everyone. Make sure, Blue Lady writes, make sure you go to whiterosesociety.org and not to the whiterosesociety.org because they're a different organization. This pitch, Blue Lady writes, is for WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks, Ben, for all you do. And thank you, Blue Lady, for Cindy for the sponsorship. It's very kind. The price of gasoline. Now, how could it be going up so high when there's no gasoline shortage? As a matter of fact, there's a gasoline surplus. How could this be? Huh? We don't even question this anymore, do we? Gregory Payton, who writes for TheExaminer.com, had this at the Madison, Wisconsin Examiner.com. He points out the gasoline prices in Madison and around the country have increased to nearly $4 a gallon, the highest price since the summer of 2008. And the so-called analysts in corporate media, you know who they are, right? Blame the increase on free market fundamentals relating to supply and demand. Hog snot. Such as OPEC policies? What? The unrest in Libya? An increased demand in China and India. The truth, Gregory writes, is that market fundamentals are not driving gasoline prices up. Libya produces about 2% of the world's oil, and only 5% of that goes to U.S. companies. Furthermore, oil production is at a record high with an adequate supply of crude to meet global demands. The commissioner of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, CFTC, his name is Bart Chilton. He recently explained that rampant oil speculation, which is at its highest level on record in 2011, is to blame for current prices. Oil speculation. A commodity market, Gregory writes, is said to be in, here's a new word, contango, C-O-N-T-A-N-G-O, contango, when demand is expected to outstrip supply and future prices are expected to rise. Big banks and companies like the Koch brothers companies employ a contango strategy by buying up oil and storing it in massive containers, both on land and offshore, to lock in the oil for sale later at a set price, sort of like the Walmart of Wall Street. Now, what most people don't know, however, Gregory writes, is that Koch Industries occupies a unique role in manipulating the oil market and is one of the top five largest distributors of gasoline and oil that engages in this practice. Koch Industries, unlike well-known oil companies, has little involvement in the extraction process of procuring crude oil. Instead, this conglomerate, Koch Industries, focuses on shipping crude, refining it, speculating on the future price, and then distributing it to retailers. In 2008, David Chang from Koch Industries drew attention among clients by bragging that falling crude prices in 2008 provided an opportunity to remove oil from the market for future delivery. He said, quote, "The drop in crude oil prices from more than $145 a barrel in July 2008 to less than $35 a barrel in December 2008 has presented opportunities for companies such as ours, Koch Industries. In the physical business," David Chang wrote, "purchase of crude oil from producers and storing offshore in tankers allow us to benefit from the contango market where crude prices are higher for future delivery than for prompt delivery," end quote. So as Gregory Payton writes, Koch Industries, like Enron, created a number of derivatives in order to leverage its privileged position in the energy industry. With control of every part of the market, the Koch brothers are not only able to bet on future oil and gasoline prices with privileged information, but they're also able to procure and withhold enough supply from the market to influence that future price. Woo, baby! Got you by the short hairs, got you by the long hairs, got you where you ain't got no hairs. Ha-ha! But that's what this sort of capitalism is all about. In December 2008, Gregory writes, Koch Industries leased, quote, four supertankers to hold oil in the U.S. Gulf Coast to take advantage of rising prices in the months ahead, end quote. Writing about Koch's contango efforts to artificially drive down supply back then, Fortune magazine writer John Berger noted they could be raising gasoline prices by anywhere from 20 to 40 cents a gallon at the time. And prices went up far more than that, of course, in recent months. The American public knows very little about the oil speculation industry because our corporate media tells next to nothing about it, and because a conservative majority on the Commodities Future Trading Commission has refused to implement a mandate from the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform Bill to provide more transparency. Transparency? And let the rubes know what we're doing? Oh, yeah. Meanwhile, Republicans are pushing drastic budget cuts to the Commodity Futures Trading Commission's budget and the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, thereby hampering any new regulations on oil commodity speculation. Watch for these agencies to be targeted on the list of budget cuts in the coming months, Gregory advises. Are the Koch brothers again buying up supply in expectation of higher crude prices during the summer or beyond, as many analysts have predicted? Based on their history, the answer is probably yes. With little regulation and oversight of the oil speculation and trading industry, however, and virtually no information made public, Americans have no way of knowing the extent to which such practices affect monthly, weekly, and even daily fluctuations of gasoline prices at the pump. Koch Industries, therefore, not only has its eye on destroying public workers' unions and acquiring publicly owned power plants and gutting environmental regulations in order for Georgia-Pacific to dump more phosphorus in rivers in states such as Wisconsin. The Koch brothers are much bigger players than that when it comes to influencing market prices and consumer spending. How about trusting the Koch brothers to run a nuclear power plant in Wisconsin with little or no regulation? Apparently, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker thinks that is a good idea. Ow! Gregory Payton, writing at MadisonExaminer.com, I believe it is. You can find it online. Thanks, Greg. Good piece. We'll be right back.
Haters of hippies like me, tree hugging, peace loving, pot smoking, porn watching, lazy ass hippies like me. Tree hugging, love making, pro choice and gay wedding, widespread digging hippies like me. Skin color blinded, conspiracy minded, protesters of corporate greed.
Redefining anger management. Yeah. It's Mike Malloy.
Revolution. Time for retribution.
Yeah. 21 past the hour. From where? Volgograd, Russia? Wait a minute. Blue?
Hey, good day, Mike.
You're calling from where?
Well, back in the USSR. We don't know how lucky we are, Mike. It used to be called Stalingrad, actually, in southern Russia.
Yeah? So what? And what's going on?
Well, we're operating another one of these convoluted charters here throughout Asia and part of Europe.
Yeah?
Yeah. I was holding on the other night.
I know you were. We never got to you, did we?
I thought maybe I'd said something wrong. I should send flowers or something.
Not to me, pal.
Yeah. Well, the reason I was calling the other day on Monday was we were in Hanoi at that point, and the day before, we'd had a very interesting meeting with two blokes who'd been in the North Vietnamese Army for about 10 or 12 years.
Yeah.
During the time of the American War. And I was actually staying in a hotel. They call it the Army Hotel. And it's believe it or not, it's run by the Army there in Hanoi, which is a very interesting city, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Much more interesting than Saigon. But, you know, they've got a saltwater swimming pool and the whole thing. They've got a gym in there. So it's quite a place, and it's all run by the Army. But they have a bureau of some kind, a registration bureau of some kind.
Yeah.
You can ask to talk to these blokes who were in the Army. And so I did, and the guy that runs it, at least the representative there at the hotel, he came back and he said, they don't want to talk to you. And I said, why not? And they said, well, this particular chap doesn't want to talk to any Americans. I said, I'm not an American. I'm an Australian. And he said, oh, that's different.
Well, you know, the Aussies played some hell with the North Vietnamese Army, too.
Well, I was about to say that there was an Australian presence. It didn't amount to much compared with the Americans. But so what happened was these two guys met with us later in the day.
Yeah.
And they were talking about their experiences. And we had an interpreter, of course, because I don't speak Vietnamese and they didn't speak English. But the gist of the thing was that they were saying, look, you know, they had been spending the best part of 10 years. The guy had been a medical student in the early 60s. And when the Americans ramped up the war there, this guy volunteered and got a commission in the Army.
Yeah.
His wife was a doctor, and she was commanding an anti-aircraft battery in north of Hanoi someplace. She was eventually killed in a bombing raid.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy spent 10 years tramping up and down the border between Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos, which they call it, the Americans call it the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And, of course, they saw a lot of things, and he said, look, What kind of people are these Americans anyway?
Yeah, that
we fought the French, and in some ways we hated the French. We were glad to get rid of them, but they didn't do the sorts of things the Americans did. And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, we would find countless examples of villages that had been razed to the ground and burned, babies that had been impaled on stakes." Women that had been raped and then thrown on piles of burning corpses and things like that. And he said, what kind of people are they? Now they're doing the same thing in Iraq and Afghanistan. And he kept shaking his head and saying, what kind of people are they? And he said, when I heard you wanted to talk to us, I thought you were another one of these Americans. They come over, they want to talk to us, they want to ask our forgiveness, they want to salve their consciences. And he said, I won't have any part of it. Some of the others will, but I won't.
Yeah.
And he said, then when I found out you were Australians, I consented to talk to you. But I think it's about time Americans started asking that question, don't you? What kind of people are the American people?
Oh yeah,
allow this stuff to go on.
Well, we asked that Boo. That's one of the driving forces of this program every night, and for the 35 or 40 people who listen to this program, I mean that's the central issue. Listen, Blue, I've got some other people on hold, and we're coming up on a break here, and I need to move on. Be careful in southern Russia. You're very close, as you well know, to the the Chechnya. So be careful. They're bombing things over there lately. Take care, Blue. I appreciate you checking in, pal. We'll be back after the break. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
San Diego. I buy some Mexicans to clean it every day. I buy Canadians, but they're all friggin' lazy. That's where the hippies went when W on the day. I will rule the world forever. I'm straight and white and male.
Chip, my fuzzy.
There's Thomas Halliburton, mass destruction.
You're listening to Resistance Radio with Mike Malloy.
Can't touch this.
Oh, yeah, you are. You know, someday that might be true. This hour is sponsored by Blue Lady. And her message is, her sponsorship is brought to you in honor of Ben Birch at the White Rose Society. She writes, please go to whiterosesociety.org and pitch in to support the wizard behind the curtain that keeps liberal radio alive for everyone. Make sure you go to whiterosesociety.org and not to the whiterosesociety.org because they're different organizations. This pitch, Blue Lady writes, is for whiterosesociety.org. Thanks, Ben, for all you do. Well, that's very nice. Ben has been, for those who don't know, he has an archive that were it printed out, it would probably stretch to the moon several times. I think he's archived every single liberal radio talk show in the history of talk radio. Nice guy. He and I and, oh, Lord, come on. Everybody's favorite writer over at Truth Out. God, I hate these brain farts. Anyway, we all met. During the big Iraq war invasion. Kathy just handed me a note. That's why I'm kind of hesitating here. Anyway, that's when I met Ben. And Kathy, who was the who's the writer from Truth Out? That Will Pitt. Oh my God! Thank you. And a bunch of other people were there. Our Boston correspondent, Matt Com. Remember Matt Com? And a bunch of other people. We all got together and really put away, what was that? No, it wasn't gin. What was it, vodka?
Tequila.
And I had a cold. This was way back in 2000. December 2002, I think. I had a bad cold, and Matt Com, and Will Pitt decided to give me some cold medicine. And they did, on top of tequila. You talk about an out-of-body experience. I want to thank you guys for doing that. Snowy is in Texas, is that right, Snowy?
Yeah, I'm a fish out of water here, Mike. I'm from Michigan myself, and every once in a while I have proved myself how backwards this state is. It's bad enough I've seen a sign in here with George W. saying, "Do you miss me yet?" But I saw a sign that, I know, I saw a sign here that absolutely took the cake. I'm driving between San Antonio and Houston towards here, and I saw a sign that made me think that, I think I went 88 miles an hour and went back in time. It was a billboard on the side with a Texas flag on it, and it said, "Yes, we can," and below it said, "Secede." I kid you not, I thought, like I said, I think I went too fast and went into a time zone.
Say it again. Yes, we can.
Yes, we can secede.
Secede, yeah, well.
It's between San Antonio and Houston on I-10.
Yes, we can.
I don't know exactly
secede.
Where it was. It was a Texas flag on the billboard, and it says, "Yes, we can secede.
Well, you know, I just wonder why they don't go ahead and do it, because Texas is one of the biggest recipients of government aid of all the 50 states. You know, let them secede, and then all those retirees down there, all those military personnel, all those former legislators and so on, all those people that are on a pension or on Medicare, all of a sudden the faucet will be turned off. Let the bastards try that for about 5 minutes, right, Snowy?
I hear you, man. I tell you what, it just, like I said, this state, I mean, and this state isn't, I mean, this area, there's pockets of, you know, sensible people here, like in Austin, Texas,
sure,
and so on, but
sure.
I just, it just stunned me. I mean, the one side pisses me off anyway, though. You know, do you miss me? Hell no, I don't. And then there's another one with Obama farther down that same road that says, you know, a picture of Obama says socialist by action and so on. And then I saw the secede sign. I was like, oh, my God. I think I had an aneurysm. I mean, jeez, old Pete.
It's
the stupidest freaking sign I think I ever saw. And I've seen some dumb signs in my 9 years of driving.
I'll bet.
This state is, ugh. You know.
I hear you. All right, Snowy, drive safely, okay?
Always, man. Take care of yourself.
All right, thanks.
Keep up good fight, man.
Stay in touch.
Will do.
All right, take care. Snowy, trucker, driving through Texas, listening on Sirius. Yeah, thanks, Snowy. The billboards, some of these billboards are just... I don't know. Beyond weird. They enter into, I don't know, what comes after weird? Oh, Republicans. Yes, we can. Secede. You're right. Oh, my God. We used to have a lot of... over-the-road drivers call us, especially when we worked out of Chicago on WLS. Fun group. Over-the-road truckers. Especially the husband-wife teams that would, they'd be out for 4, 5, 6, 7 days and away from home and call in and... That was cool. Some of the reports that we would get from, from men and women who were over the road drivers, and all the stuff that you see, you know, you and I are pretty stationary unless you have that kind of a job, you know, stuff kind of, collects around us. But when you're an over the road, trucker, you know, you're flowing right through it. You're just like, shoom. You're just moving through it. Made for great. I always thought it made for good talk radio. Lane is driving through Mesa, Arizona. Another over-the-road driver, right?
Yeah. Hi, Mike. How you doing?
I'm all right, Lane. How are you?
Good. Hey, we last talked on the Friday. You're going to laugh. On the Friday before Barack Obama got elected on Tuesday. And it just makes me laugh to think about our conversation. I was talking about... What is it? Health care for everyone, or
right.
Care for everyone?
Right.
Care Part E, they called it.
Uh huh.
How disappointed now we are in that. But hey, a little story on voter fraud, or whatever you want to call it. I know personally, the truck driver that was sent after 30,000 ballots that were supposed to go to the poor sections of Denver.
Right, right.
And that morning he woke up and he was called off of that load. And then later in the day he was called by the, not the dispatcher, but the broker, and asked about his party affiliation and things, you
right.
know?
Uh-huh.
And, well, to make a long story short, those 30,000 ballots never showed up in Denver in the poorer parts of the neighborhood. You may recall the story about there not being enough ballots to go around.
Well, that was such a common story in so many precincts. That happened in Ohio. It happened in Florida. And always, you know, Jacksonville, Florida, around Cleveland, Ohio, and always... the rat bastards target the so-called minority neighborhoods. It happened here in Atlanta. They target the so-called minority neighborhoods. The whole idea of the Republicans is voter suppression, to try to cut off the ability to vote among the groups that the Republicans figure are going to vote Democrat anyway. Which is a real racist thing. I mean, you know, just to assume that black folk are going to vote for a Democrat, or that Latinos are going to vote for a Democrat, or what have you. And then to cut off that segment of the population, it's some bad stuff, Lane. You know, one of these days, these people are going to get caught, and there's going to be some utter hell to pay. Lane, I got to leave you there. Thanks, pal. Stay in touch. Don't wait another 3 years to call in. We'll be back after the break. Now the mayor's been reduced to crying. And guess what said? Niggas been used to dying. He said, I know it looks bad. Just have to wait. But get it. For the hour. This hour has been sponsored by Blue Lady, a.k.a. Cindy, who writes, brought to you in honor of Ben Birch at the White Rose Society. Go to whiterosesociety.org and pitch in to support the wizard behind the curtain that keeps liberal radio alive for everyone. Make sure you go to whiterosesociety.org and not to the whiterosesociety.org, because they're a different organization. This pitch is for whiterosesociety.org. Thanks, Ben, for all you do. And thank you, Cindy, for the sponsorship. Very kind. By the way, coming up next hour, in response to an awful lot of requests from people, a 9/11 truth story that I think you're going to find, you know, I've said it before, I don't buy the garbage put out by the commission, 9/11 commission, or the federal government. You know that. That and... some reportage on Bradley Manning. And an interesting email that I got from our education affairs correspondent, Kay Petrini. Stick around. You're going to just love it. Mark is in San Francisco, listening on Green 960. Hey, Mark.
Mike, how are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm hanging in there, buddy, trying to fight this Republican agenda again.
I hear that.
But, you know, this Reaganomics. Do you think we'll ever see an end to this Reaganomics in our lifetime?
I think we've already seen it. It's gone on to the next level. But let's remember what Reaganomics, I get your question, but let's remember what Reaganomics was about. It was about putting the country so far in debt that... the pitch could then begin that in order to get out of debt, because debt's going to kill us, you know, we had to cut every single social program there is. We can't cut the military. We spend $1 trillion a year on the military, but can't touch that. So I think Reaganomics, what it was designed to do, has been done, don't you?
Well, yes, but I think they're trying to take it to the next level, the final level, which is the death nail in the middle class and also the country.
Well, that's true.
With this path to prosperity. I think basically we're at the crossroads right now, whether we're going to reject this once and for all or whether we're just going to go down in flames with it. I think that we're seeing the crossroads right now, Mike, and I think that the path to prosperity not only destroys the country, economically the middle class, but also it kills the United States in competing with the rest of the countries in education, in green energy. It puts us down in a hole so deep, it's unbelievable what these crazy Republicans are doing to this country. And people need to understand, if they love their country, they're going to have to get up and fight this once and for all. I never want to see Reaganomics ever again in my lifetime, if I can help it, Mike.
I hear you.
30 years is enough.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. No, you're right. I have the feeling that we, like you, that we're at some kind of a crossroads here, and it's coming closer and closer and closer, where the people of this country who still believe in our system, our culture, whatever it is, our society, our country, we're going to have to do something. And you know, and I'm sure you think about this too, Mark, writing letters to the editor or holding an online discussion is not going to cut it. We're going to have to do, it's going to have to be in the streets. It's going to have to be civil disobedience. And if they don't respond to that, then it's going to have to be massive civil disobedience. If they don't respond to that, then whatever comes next, and I think most people understand what comes next.
Mike, really, what could come down the road is the Koch brothers and the Chamber of Commerce, the predators that are funding this assault on us, they're going to be exposed. People are going to know who's doing this to us. And I can tell you, basically, that I'll do whatever I can to make sure they get the message that I don't appreciate what they're doing to my country or what they're doing to the people of this country. Because to me, those people ought to be called out. They're the real predators of this country. They're traitors.
That's right. That's
right. And they're funding this. And they can't hide behind the Republican Party, the Supreme Court. They're out there, and people know who they are. And if they don't think there's going to be some consequences, well, they're thinking wrong, because there's some people that'll deal with them.
Yeah, I completely agree with that, Mark. You know, you can only push people so far. You can only throw enough millions of people out on the street, out of their homes, and take away people's jobs and destroy their savings and tell them to smile while you're gutting them. You can only do that so long until finally people say, okay, I've been patient. I've let you run over me. I've let you kick my ass. I've let you do all this. Now the day of reckoning is here. You're absolutely right. It's going to come. It's going to come unless these people wise up and back off. Unless I don't know. I think though that we have to go even deeper into this crap that the Republicans are putting on us until we finally respond.
Well, hopefully, what's happening in Wisconsin, hopefully that'll be a tidal wave that'll really get all over the country. That's what's happening there, is the same blueprint they're trying to push on them. This path to prosperity is the same baloney in a different form, but the same result. And it's all in the name of greed. They don't care about the country. They don't care if people lose their jobs. In fact, even though the Republicans help lose all our jobs, now the safety nets that we need because of them, they want to get rid of that too. So, if they think people aren't pissed off, they got another thing coming, because there's some pissed off people.
That's absolutely correct. Mark, thanks, man. I appreciate you checking in. I hope you call again. We're flat out of time for this hour, pal. Thanks a lot. Take care, Mark. Oy, 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 oy. All right, 9/11 truth coming at you when we come back. And there's a court case regarding the events of 9/11 at the Pentagon that I think you'll find some of the particulars of this case weird. And Bradley Manning, some more updates on him. Stick around, okay? I'm Mike Malloy. past the hour. I had this last night, but didn't have time to read it. It's an email from our education affairs correspondent, Kate Petrini. And she writes, "Hi, Mike. As I was preparing a practice test for my AP government class today, I came across this question. The federal constitution guarantees all of the following rights to a person arrested and charged with a serious crime, except the right to A, remain silent, B, be represented by a lawyer, C, negotiate a plea bargain, D, demand a writ of habeas corpus, E, receive a speedy and public trial. The answer, of course, is C, negotiate a plea bargain. There's no constitutional guarantee for that. And Kay writes, this is where my brain starts to hurt, because, as all truth seekers know, C is false, negotiate a plea bargain. In post-Bush crime family America, we need to add another option. The federal constitution guarantees all of the following rights to a person arrested and charged with a serious crime, except F, all of the above. Just ask Bradley Manning. Well, obviously, the point that Kay is making is what has happened to Bradley Manning. The latest press release from the Bradley Manning Support Network. And in this release, it says the 8 months of solitary confinement of Bradley Manning at Quantico has drawn national and international criticism in the last week. Support is growing for him around the world, with 500,000 writing President Obama in the last few days, and with hundreds of top U.S. legal scholars criticizing his condition of confinement. Now, let me digress a moment. This is another reason why I feel nothing but an absolute, utter, complete, personal betrayal by the man I voted for to be president in 2008. I mean, seriously, you know, lofty rhetoric is one thing, and political theory and this position and that position. And, well, there's a wherefore and a what if. And, gee, let's intellectualize this a little bit further. You know, if you're a regular listener to this program, you know, to that I say bat squeeze. I would say something else, but I can't because, you know, part of the program goes over public radio, public airwaves, I should say. But forget the rhetoric. Forget the crap. Barack Obama could end this torture of Bradley Manning 10 minutes from now. A month ago. 5 months ago. 14 days ago. 162 hours ago. But he won't. And the reason President Obama won't is because he is terrified of what would happen if he did. Lawyers representing every leading law school in the United States have written an open letter to Obama criticizing the conditions of Bradley Manning. Among the law professors is Lawrence Tribe, who was Obama's law professor at Harvard and who served in the Obama administration until recently. The letter, which was titled Private Manning's Humiliation, it's available online if you want to read it, raises questions about Obama, saying, quote, President Obama was once a professor of constitutional law and entered the national stage as an eloquent moral leader. The question now, however, is whether his conduct as commander-in-chief meets fundamental standards of decency, end quote. Do you get that? Whether or not Barack Obama's behavior as Commander-in-Chief meets fundamental, basic, elemental, fundamental, bottom line standards of decency. You want my answer on that? Colonel Anne Wright. I happen to have met her personally and talked with her at a demonstration in front of Quantico a couple of weeks ago. She chose to get arrested. I chose not to at Quantico. Colonel Anne Wright, who served 29 years in the military, said, quote, President Obama could end the treatment of Manning with one phone call. As Commander-in-Chief, he's responsible for the actions of the Marines at Quantico. Clearly, he understands the constitutional right to be convicted before punished, and that the condition of Manning violates protection from cruel and unusual punishment, end quote, Colonel Anne Wright. The UN rapporteur, is that how you pronounce that? On torture? Reporter on torture, Juan Mendez, reprimanded the United States for blocking an official visit with Manning to investigate his treatment. The UN torture investigator has been reviewing Manning's case since December, but the U.S. will not allow a private meeting with no tape recording. No private meeting, no tape recording, no nothing. The military has also refused Congressman Dennis Kucinich's request for an official visit to Manning. The military has also refused a visit from Amnesty International. What kind of a military is this? Is it the military that has now eaten alive the revolution in Egypt? This is a military that operates the way all militaries operate. Unthinking, unable to make an independent decision, terrified that the chain of command will somehow be disturbed. Nobody wants to do anything, but the military clamps down. And at the head of the line of the United States military establishment is Barack Obama. Barack Obama is at the very apex, the tip of the spear. There he is, the president, the commander-in-chief. And what is he doing? Daniel Ellsberg. A veteran who graduated from Quantico and is noted for leaking the Pentagon Papers, and with whom I have demonstrated and been arrested, said, quote, it seems likely that the Pentagon's refusal to allow Amnesty International and the UN reporter on torture to hold unmonitored discussion with Bradley Manning, as the UN mandate demands, reflects well-founded fear that such experts on abusive conditions and torture could conclude that Manning's treatment is not only ridiculous, counterproductive, and stupid, as State Department spokesperson P.J. Crowley was forced to resign for saying, but also criminal, end quote, Daniel Ellsberg. Now, this comes at a time when the U.S. and China are challenging each other's record on human rights. Can you believe that? More on this, we'll be right back. Won't go back. Said the family suffer, but it hurts me more to hear a scab say, sod you, Jack. Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you? Follow my conscience, and I'll do whatever I can. But it'll take much more than a union law to knock the fight out of a working man. Which side are madness and the same?
You're listening to Resistance Radio with Mike Malloy.
Past the hour, we're talking about Bradley Manning and his torture and confinement, and the fact that Barack Obama is not only allowing this to happen, he is sanctioning its happening. He could stop it, as Colonel Ann Wright has pointed out, with one phone call. All of this focus on the treatment of Bradley Manning comes at a time, and this is where the global political stage is entered. A time when U.S. and China are challenging each other on human rights. China issued a lengthy report regarding human rights violations in the U.S. Recently, as P.J. Crowley, former Assistant Secretary of State, said when he resigned, the Manning case would be an embarrassment to the U.S. internationally, highlighting, quote, the broader, even strategic impact of discrete actions undertaken by national security agencies every day and their impact on our global standing and leadership. He went on to say the exercise of power in today's challenging times and relentless media environment must be prudent and consistent with our laws and values, end quote. A cynic could make the argument that P.J. Crowley is speaking from a parallel universe, because after all, torture is now sanctioned by the United States, isn't it? Isn't that what all of the attorneys general that worked and the legal advisors that worked for the corrupt and filthy and criminal Bush-Cheney regime, isn't that what they determined? That torture, suspension of the Constitution, labeling people in a certain manner to deprive them not just of U.S. constitutional rights, which they may or may not be entitled to, but human rights. Isn't that, or wasn't that, a fait accompli by the Bush crime family? And so now what is Barack Obama doing? Same thing. Same thing. Only you can make the argument a little bit worse, because Bradley Manning is a 23-year-old American Army private. I mean, after all, most U.S. administrations put a much higher value on the lives and treatment of U.S. soldiers than on the lives and treatment of so-called enemy combatants. N'est-ce pas? Of course. So, as the press release from Bradley Manning Support Network points out, around the world there's a growing anger at the treatment of Manning. 500,000 people have sent letters to Obama urging him to immediately end the torture, isolation, and public humiliation of Bradley Manning. The petition is addressed to Obama, Secretary of State Clinton, and Secretary of Defense Gates. Jeff Patterson, a military veteran speaking on behalf of the Bradley Manning Support Network, said, quote, 500,000 people have taken a stand in support of Bradley Manning. It's certainly a challenge to President Obama to get on the right side of history here and finally put an end to the extreme and illegal pretrial punishment. After he ends the mistreatment of Manning, he could then ensure that Bradley receives the fair and public trial that is guaranteed under the Constitution, end quote. So I would, that's from the Bradley Manning Support Network. BradleyManning.org is the website if you want to check it out, BradleyManning.org. So just a thought, just a question. What good regarding American justice, regarding the U.S. Constitution, regarding the respect that this country is supposed to show for equal protection under the law? What theory regarding all that is being advanced by this treatment of Bradley Manning? How is Bradley Manning's humiliation, incarceration, and torture, how is that advancing or enhancing respect for law in this country? Anybody got an answer to that? Is Barack Obama, no, let me rephrase it. It's not a question, it's a statement. Barack Obama is consciously, deliberately, purposefully, denying basic human and constitutional rights to an American soldier being held at a Marine brig in Virginia and being subjected to torture, to break him down, to try to get him, I guess this is the idea, to admit to a conspiracy between Bradley Manning, Julian Assange, and whoever else had the absolute temerity, no, the absolute courage to reveal the truth. Shame on you, Barack Obama. Shame on you. Shame on you. Shame on you.
A thousand people in the street, singing songs and carrying signs, mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Paranoia strikes deep into your life, it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line.
Ammunition against right-wing rhetoric. Get locked and loaded with Mike Malloy.
Before the hour. Have you heard about this lawsuit that is in front of the Second Circuit of the United States Court of Appeals? Have you heard of someone named April Gallop, G-A-L-L-O-P? No, I hadn't either. And Sheila sent this to me. There's a 9/11 lawsuit against former high officials in the Bush White House. And it's being presided over by a cousin of former President George W. Bush. Heard about this? No. If that's not a conflict of interest, then the term conflict of interest no longer applies to anything where it concerns jurisprudence in this country. It just doesn't apply. It's an unworkable statement. George W. Bush's cousin, Judge John M. Walker, you know, like George Walker Bush, Judge John M. Walker of the Second Circuit, the United States Court of Appeals, is part of a three-judge panel hearing the case of April Gallop versus Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, and Richard Meyer, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Richard Myers. The case has been ignored totally by mainstream media in the weeks leading up to it going to court April 5th. Most media have ignored the developments concerning the involvement of Judge Walker. One exception is CNBC. And I defy you to find the story on CNBC. According to Global Research, CNBC carried an online story with the headline, quote, "Extraordinary Conflict of Interest. Bush Cousin Presides Over Federal Court Case Against Former Bush Administration Officials," unquote. That's the heading. That's the headline. I looked all over CNBC earlier today, could find nothing. I don't know. Maybe it's been taken down. Maybe it's there, and I just don't know how to look for a story. But, so CNBC, the only mainstream media outlet to report on this at all, and as Global Research says, good for them. But it's an isolated exception. CNBC, who in the hell watches CNBC for this kind of news, right? CNBC, isn't that owned by NBC? Oh, never mind. that the story is being kept entirely out of the media further reveals that the idea, chuckle, chuckle, giggle, giggle, of a free and vigorous press, a liberal media, is nonsense. It's some kind of a devil made up by crazy right-wing Republicans. Liberal media! Mm-hmm. The story, quickly, April Gallup is a former U.S. Army executive administrative assistant with top secret clearance. Former U.S. Army executive administrative assistant, which means she probably was not in the military, but worked in the Pentagon. Top secret clearance, is suing for damages in connection with injuries she and her newborn son suffered in the supposed terrorist attack at the Pentagon on September 11, 2001. Ms. Gallup and her baby were injured when the allegedly hijacked American Airlines Flight 77 supposedly slammed into the Pentagon. Ms. Gallup and many others in the 9/11 truth movement contend that explosives were planted inside the Pentagon and that Flight 77 never hit the building. Gallup says a large explosion caused the ceiling above her to collapse. When she regained consciousness, she made her way with her son with her through the hole the alleged plane was supposed to have created. She says she never saw any evidence that a plane had hit the building. Oh, my. An eyewitness, someone who was injured, made her way out of, through the hole, plane. Well, of course, the woman was in shock, right? The woman was blinded to the huge chunks of fuselage that were all around her, right? I mean, this was an American Airlines jet, right? A commercial airliner, right? Wasn't it American Airlines? Big old jet plane, but poor April Gallup just, oh, I don't know, you know, dazed, shocked, got her infant with her. She must have just not seen this huge aircraft that had slammed into the Pentagon, as apparently neither did any of the literally scores, if not hundreds of cameras pointed at the Pentagon. Isn't it amazing? Isn't it the only time in U.S. history that the heart and soul of U.S. militarism is attacked, and there's no physical, no video record of it having ever occurred? Not a bit. Nothing. Isn't that, well, you know what that is, don't you? Now, Craig McKee, writing at Global Research, says, as I reported in a previous post, the Pentagon has refused to help Gallup with surgeries that she and her son have required because of the event. They've even tried to stop other agencies like the American Red Cross from helping her. According to David Ray Griffin's account in his book, The New Pearl Harbor Revisited. I know you're all familiar with David Ray Griffin. Anyway, Ms. Gallup launched the original lawsuit in 2008, alleging that the 9/11 attacks were planned at the highest levels of the U.S. government and that they were blamed on fundamentalist Muslims as part of a cover story. She claims that there was plenty of knowledge that employees of the Pentagon were in imminent danger and that had alarms been sounded, many deaths and injuries would have been prevented. According to official reports, 125 people were killed at the Pentagon and 89 on the plane. Ms. Gallup, in her lawsuit, contends all of that could have been avoided. The murders would not have occurred. The idea now that Dick Cheney knew a plane was heading for the Pentagon is supported by the 9/11 Commission hearing testimony, as fouled up and as nasty and as much of a cover-up as that was. But Norman Mineta, then Transportation Secretary, reported to the commission, the 9/11 commission, that Cheney was in the presidential bunker prior to the Pentagon crash and was tracking the plane as it approached the Pentagon, but not taking action to intercept it. Ever wonder why? I mean, really, the second in command of the United States, and the United States, according to this pig, is under attack. Under attack. The worst attack since the War of 1812. Under attack. And he sits in the bunker and watches this plane approach and does nothing. You ever wonder why? Cheney is insane. Well, that's one possibility. Cheney is a co-conspirator to destroy the United States. Ah, that one even makes more sense, doesn't it? The original case brought by April Gallup was thrown out of court in March of last year, March of 2010. Judge Denny Chin dismissed the suit with prejudice, contending that her complaint was based on, quote, cynical delusion and fantasy, end quote. Cynical delusion and fantasy. Oh, by the way, Judge Chin has now been promoted to the very court that's now hearing the appeal of his own ruling. Huh? You like that? Isn't this just so goddamn cool and neat and precise and just all the pieces so neatly fit together? What? Somebody filed a complaint? Oh, that's easy to take care of. George W. Bush's cousin is on the court, and Denny Chin, who dismissed it with prejudice, is also on the court. Hey, this will be a piece of cake. These goddamn 9/11 truthers. Boy, are we sick of these pigs, right? Bunch of conspiracy theorists, right? Little more on this when we come back. Judge Gallup also murdered... I'm sorry, not Judge Gallup. Gallup is the name of the complainant. Judge John Walker also murdered a cop. You want to hear that? Come on back. April Gallup suing for damages because of what happened to her as a Pentagon employee. She contends on 9/11. She contends that Cheney, Myers, then chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and George W. Bush were co-conspirators. And the lawyer, or I'm sorry, the judge presiding over her case is... Judge John M. Walker, a first cousin to both Presidents Bush. Now, Ms. Gallup's lawyer, William Veal, made a motion this week to have Judge Walker disqualified from hearing the case, but this was denied. Also denied was the request for a continuance to appeal that decision. Now, this case is going to go nowhere. Here is someone who walked out of the Pentagon through the gaping hole caused by the cough, cough, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, American Airlines Flight 77 and states that she didn't see anything that would indicate an airliner had slammed into the Pentagon. But, oh, you know. Her case is going nowhere. And it'll be done nicely, neatly, and legally with a series of people involved on the bench who are there specifically to squash these kinds of ridiculous complaints. A complaint labeled by a judge, Denny Chin, who dismissed it as cynical delusion and fantasy. Get out of here. Get out of here, Miss Gallup, and take your brat with you. What do you mean you have a lawsuit against Bush, Cheney, and Myers? What are you talking about? You didn't see the crashed airliner? Well, you were obviously in a state of shock of some sort. So now get out of my courtroom. Judge Walker was Chief Justice of the Court of Appeals from 2000 to 2006, and he's been serving as a senior member of the court since then. Now, many researchers into 9/11 also point out that another Bush cousin, Wirt D. Walker III, was CEO of Securicom from 1999 to 2002. That's the company that handled security at the World Trade Center. The company installed an $8.3 million security system in the towers between 1996 and 2000, which is coincidental to Miss April Gallup's lawsuit. Now, Judge Walker, there seems to be, I don't know, there's something about the Bush family that they kill people with cars. And nothing ever happens. On the evening of October 17th, 2006, as he began his drive home to Madison, Connecticut, Judge Walker, the one who will not hear a lawsuit brought against his cousin by April Gallup, Judge Walker's Ford Escape automobile struck a police officer named Daniel Picagli. In New Haven, Connecticut, the officer was directing traffic at a road construction site. There were no construction signs or traffic cones marking off the site. Picagli died 4 days later on October 21st, 2006. According to Police Chief Francisco Ortiz, quote, he had been wearing a black raincoat and a reflective vest. Ortiz said the officers who went to the scene of this death, quote, did not feel it was necessary to test Walker for drugs or alcohol, end quote. Now, I don't know how it works in Connecticut. I have no idea. Here in Georgia, you're involved in a fatal accident. Oh, are they going to test you for drugs and alcohol? Oh, my God, are they going to test you? But not Judge Walker. Now, Walker stopped immediately after hitting the police officer. And New Haven police have said the cause of this fatal accident was not related to drugs or alcohol. How do they know that? Well, they just know it. A police investigation that went as far as it did reported that Judge Walker, quote, was traveling at a slow speed through the dark and rainy construction site, end quote. The prosecutor declined to press charges, saying nothing indicated, quote, intentional, negligent, or reckless conduct, end quote, by Walker. Well, that's certainly good to know, isn't it? And how does everybody know that Judge Walker was not impaired by drugs and or alcohol, whether they were legal prescription drugs or illegal prescription drugs, the way Rush Limbaugh conducted his miserable, bloated life. Perhaps it was alcohol. I mean, after all, a judge of the status of Judge Walker is probably under a tremendous amount of stress. maybe a cocktail or two before going home, huh? Just, you know, just a little snort. Ah, no? Didn't happen? How do you know? Oh, well, never mind. Members of the Bush family, either directly or indirectly, blood members or people who marry in, are just prone to killing people with automobiles. It's just the damnedest thing. It's just the damnedest thing. April Gallup's case will disappear. Imagine a lawsuit against Bush and Cheney regarding 9/11. Right. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.